Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jeff Whittington. Chris Boyd is off today. When was your last visit to a national park, and what's your favorite national park site in Texas? Now, whether you love the East Texas woodland habitat of the Big Thicket Preserve or the solitude found in the deserts and mountains of Big Bend National Park, our state's national parks can deliver it all. Or maybe your family's summer vacation calls for a history lesson on the 36th President of the United States or a journey back in time. Well, you might want to visit the LBJ Ranch or the centuries-old Spanish missions of San Antonio, if that's the case. Now, our guest this hour knows a lot about the Texas National Parks, and he's seen and worked at a lot of parks around the country over his 35-year career. Russ Whitlock currently serves as the Texas Coordinator for the National Park Service and as Superintendent of the Lyndon Baines Johnson National Historical Park. Russ, welcome to Think, and thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
You bet. So let's start out a little bit, start with you talking a little bit about the mission of the National Park Service within Texas.
The mission of the National Park Service in Texas reflects our mission nationwide. Today, the national parks cover 403 sites across the nation: Guam, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and American Samoa. And the sites of Texas really reflect the vast variety of monuments and battlefields and recreation areas and national parks. Our goal, it really started in 1916 with the Organic Act, when Congress and the President said, you will conserve and share these places with the American public and the world. And we have been working at that for almost 100 years now.
Now, by the time we had the Organic Act, there were already 14 national parks and, you know, almost two dozen national monuments, et cetera. So there was already sort of a National Park Service going before 1916.
There was. There was a great cry by business people and travel enthusiasts and the railroads and conservationists all that there needed to be some type of federal park system that could protect these areas. Before that, many of the national battlefields, which were mostly Civil War and some revolutionary sites, and the Yosemites and Yellowstones of the world were being administered by the Army. That's why the National Park Service uniform looks so much like a military uniform today, with the drill sergeant hat, because that's still a holdover from that heritage. But in 1916, when President Wilson signed the Organic Act and created the National Park Service, many, even to this day, say that it's one of the greatest gifts of the nation to the world, because it created a nationwide system to protect, conserve, and share those places.
Now, I know we're going to talk about the parks in Texas and the parks in general today, but I'm really curious about your history with the parks. And, you know, want to know when you knew that you wanted to work in the national parks. Was it the hat originally, or was it an experience as a kid? Take us back and tell us about your initial interest in being in the Park Service.
Well, I was growing up in the 1960s, and I was the son of a mill worker in South Carolina. And every year on the 4th of July, they shut down the mill for 2 weeks for the holiday and for repairs. And Dad and Mom and my younger sister, we loaded up in our Chevy with our little pop-up camper behind us, and we headed for the Great Smoky Mountains and the Blue Ridge Parkway and the national parks of that area. So I grew up watching the uniformed maintenance men and going to the campfire programs and going along with the guided hikes and walks and things. I think that instilled that first love for me. But then I kind of disconnected in my late high school and college years, and then when I was a sophomore, I needed a summer job, and I was in Charleston, and I went to Fort Sumter National Monument, and I walked up like countless other young men and women have and said, "Do y'all hire people for the summer?" And they said, "Absolutely, we sure do, and here's how you apply, and here's what you do." And you know, the rest was history. I was majoring in pharmacy, and spent a summer guiding tours in Mammoth Cave in Kentucky, and came back and changed my major and my whole life direction, Boy, I've never regretted it for a moment.
So, you know, people think national park and they think of trails, rivers, wildlife. But you make a good point. Your first experience was in an historic site. And talk a little bit about, you know, the difference in the mix of the sites that we have around the country and here in Texas as well.
That's one of the most frustrating things that those of us who work in places that aren't called national park have to deal with educating the traveling public. You go to your local bookstore or you go online and you Google national parks and you'll get about 57, 58 that pop up. But remember, there's 403 national park sites. The problem is the great variety. There are 27 different designations, and you see that reflected in Texas. I mean, there's the Amistad National Recreation Area, the Lake Meredith Recreation Area, the San Antonio Missions National Historic Site, the LBJ National Historical Park, the Guadalupe and Big Bend National Parks, Fort Davis National Historic Site, the Alabates Flint Quarry. So it's oftentimes confusing when people roll into a place and they see a national park uniform and they go, I didn't know this was a national park. And it's like, well, yeah, there's lots of different types of national parks. And our goal really is to share not only the great land masses that we love in our nation, but so many of the stories, the story of the struggle for civil rights, the story of the American Revolution, of the Mexican-American War. You know, all of those things are part of the themes that make up our American history and our society and culture.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Think Today. I'm Jeff Whittington in for Chris Boyd, and our guest this hour is Russ Whitlock. He's the Texas National Parks Coordinator, and he's superintendent of the LBJ National Historical Park. Russ, drill in a little bit for us and, you know, talk about, there's a unique process about the LBJ Park where you are part of the administration, but talk a little bit about generally about, you have a historic site, you have a place where something happened. What does it take, and what's the process for it to become a national historical park or a historic site?
Okay. The president, under the Antiquities Act, has the authority to basically quick claim, protect national monuments. But it's the Congress that creates the national parks and any of the other designations, and then often the Congress will come back and endorse the president's designation of a national monument. For ours, I think it was our beloved Lady Bird Johnson. When I've done programs for different groups and all in the Dallas area, I often see that look of astonishment when people hear that there are 13 different national park sites across our state. And I quickly remind them that Lady Bird Johnson was an educator and a conservative, a conservationist and a journalist and a historian. And I think if we were naming this park today, Jeff, it would probably be the Lyndon Baines and Lady Bird Johnson National Historical Park, because we know that her legacy is so important. President Johnson only visited one national park site during his 5 years in office. That was the Statue of Liberty when he signed an immigration law. But Mrs. Johnson basically drug the Secretary of the Interior all over the nation talking about how these areas should be set aside or should be added to or preserved or set. And her legacy is reflected in his signature on 39 national park bills, more than any other president in the history of our nation.
Wow. So now he may not have visited a lot of national parks, but he spent a lot of time there at the ranch, which was called the Texas White House, right?
He certainly did. During the 1960s, the world came to the hill country of Texas. Lyndon Johnson was born and raised here. Billy Graham, at his eulogy in 1973, said to know Lyndon Johnson, you had to realize that his roots in this soil ran as deep as a live oak tree. He made 75 trips to the ranch during his 5 years in office. There was a one-mile-long airstrip that was built in the middle of the ranch to bring what Mrs. Johnson called the Washington Shuttle in, and that was members of the Congress and the Joint Chiefs and his advisory staff and world leaders and others that would come there. So it was sort of his Camp David. He went to Camp David a few times, but whenever possible, he came to the ranch, and it was not a vacation time. The one quarter of his presidency, or about 16 months of it spent working from the ranch, was very much working time. You can look back at the presidential diaries and see that. But of course, he loved to throw the big barbecues on the banks of the river under the big live oak trees, and he loved sharing with his friends and other leaders from around the country and the world this beautiful part of Texas that he loved so much.
What are some of visitors' favorite aspects of the LBJ Historical Park?
There, I like to say, Jeff, that our presidential site, probably among all of the ones that are set aside, is the most comprehensive. We've got the cabin where his grandparents got involved in the cattle industry, rounding up longhorns and driving them up the Chisholm Trail. We've got the house he was born in, the first school where he started when he was 4 years old. His mother was a college graduate from Baylor Women's College. The house he grew up in Johnson City, and then, of course, the ranch that he and Mrs. Johnson, probably with her good investments in radio stations, bought in 1951 when he was in the Senate. So we can take you from his ancestry through his birth, childhood, experiences in this area, and then the place where he ran the nation. Basically, he was the first president who could, to use a modern term, could virtually work away from Washington, because he had 72 long distance phone lines at the ranch.
Wow.
He had a microwave system, he had very early satellite communication systems, and he had that airport where people could easily come and go. So he could actually run the nation from Texas as if he was sitting in the Oval Office in Washington.
Now, there's quite a collection of cars, too, at the site, right?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people wonder if we're a historical park for a president, or if we're an antique car repository. But you know, there's so many photographs of him in those convertible Lincoln Continentals. It was not unusual at all, and I heard Mrs. Johnson recite this many times, that, you know, they would just, in the middle of the afternoon, he would just stand up from the desk and say, let's go for a ride, let's go check on the cattle or see how the hay operation's going, or go see what the deer are doing over in this section. And there's countless photographs of that Lincoln bouncing through the pastures.
And he took visitors around in the car, too, on extensive sightseeing tours of the property.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, the Roy Butler, who was the Lincoln dealer at the time in Austin, said that LBJ always wanted to be the first one with the new model every year. They would deliver it to the ranch, and he would floorboard it from one end of the airstrip to the other. That was his test drive, and he'd bring it back. And he said, "But we were constantly bringing out replacements and replacing those." And he said, "Mr. President, I'd be happy to supply you with a fleet of Jeeps or something like that, or trucks." And he didn't want that. He loved those big, you know, land yachts, as we would call them today. And we've actually, our friends group actually bought us one that we use in parades and things like that today as a calling card for the ranch.
Our guest this hour is Russ Whitlock. He's the Texas National Parks Coordinator and the superintendent of the LBJ National Historical Park. We'd love to get your calls at 800-933-5372. Your questions about national parks in Texas and elsewhere. You can also email us think@kera.org. We're going to branch out a little bit and talk about some of the other National Park Service sites after a quick break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
It is the preservation of the scenery, of the forests, and the wilderness game for the people as a whole. Instead of leaving the enjoyment thereof to be confined to the very rich, it is noteworthy in its essential democracy. One of the best bits of national achievement which our people have to their credit. And our people should see to it that they are preserved for their children and their children's children forever. With their majestic beauty, all unmarred. Theodore Roosevelt.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jeff Whittington, in today for Chris Boyd, and our guest this hour is Russ Whitlock. He's the Texas National Parks Coordinator and Superintendent of the LBJ National Historical Park. Of course, that was a cut from and a quote from Theodore Roosevelt from Ken Burns' series, The National Parks. You can call us at 800-933-5372. You can email us anything. I'm sorry, it's think@kera.org. My anything brain was taken over there. You can also send me a tweet this hour if you have a question for Russ Whitlock. I'm at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. Let's go to the phones at 800-933-5372 and talk to Kathy in Dallas. Hello, Kathy.
Hi. I just wanted to make a brief comment. My son and I, the LBJ National Historical Site is actually surrounded by land that the LBJ family still owns. And they happen to own the guest house adjacent to the main house where the cabinet would come and stay on those weekends when LBJ would be at the ranch. And my son and I had the opportunity to rent that. I mean, it's available on VRBO. And it was so nice to be able to kind of live history by being there after hours and kind of thinking about how LBJ and Lady Bird would spend those evenings in the quiet of the Texas Hill Country. And we also really enjoyed looking at the extensive car collection.
Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you.
Russ, do you hear from folks a lot who you know travel down to the area and are sort of trying to re-experience the LBJ days?
We do. And what she got to enjoy of staying at the old guest house was, part of the stepping back in history. That's the beauty of so many of the national historical parks and historic sites and all, is you can walk in the footsteps and experience a lot of the same landscapes and environments that the famous people experienced. And you can sometimes relate to what motivated them and some of their decisions or the actions that they took like that. Yeah, when you rent the guest house, you basically have the ranch all to yourself after we close up at 5 o'clock. That's one of the nice benefits of renting the Johnson guest house, is the entire ranch is yours after 5 o'clock.
Well, let's move a little bit south and talk a little bit about the San Antonio Missions Historic Park site. Now, they're a little bit older, several hundred years old. How did the missions end up as part of the national park system?
It's a story of a lot of the cooperation that the National Park Service enjoys with state parks and local history organizations and private businesses and philanthropic organizations. The state of Texas had been in control and managing a number of those sites, and there was an arrangement made because of the national importance of those, the politics lined up, and they switched over to the National Park Service. But the state is still very much involved. The Texas Historical Commission and the State Historic Preservation Officer and their staff are in lockstep with us as we preserve those state and national treasures. The missions have been nominated by the United States to become a World Heritage Site, mm-hmm. which will be the first in Texas. And the nomination will be introduced at the June 2015 Congress in Berlin next year.
And I'm sure there's a lot that goes into it. You have a lot of people with really special, specific talents, even at a park like the LBJ Historical Park. But there've got to be some special challenges with preserving structures and buildings like those missions, because they were made, you know, over 200 years ago.
Oh, there are. We frustrate contractors oftentimes when we say we need to repair this roof or we need to replace some rotted wood and things like that, and they say, well, great, I'll just get some good pressure-treated lumber that we can put in there and it'll last for the next 50 to 75 years. And we're like, no, that was hand-hewn cedar or oak or poplar or something. It's got to go back in the same exact way. The Park Service is very much sticklers for accuracy, and whenever possible, we use historic photographs and documentation and recordings and diary entries and all kinds of things to try to keep it as accurate as possible. It usually costs a lot more, you know, than doing it the more conventional way of using modern materials, but it allows us to keep the reality and the significance of the site and the place that way.
Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email us. Our email address is think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones and get a question from Rhonda in Murphy. Hello, Rhonda.
Hi. Hi. This is such an interesting conversation because a couple months ago I was in Atlanta, and I did not know that the King Memorial site was a National Historical Site. And even though I went to college in Atlanta and I've gone back, you know, several times, I'm from that area, and it also so happens that my childhood friend is the superintendent of the park there. So I was able to get a personal tour from her, and it was just so exciting, though. Even though I thought I knew a lot about the civil rights movement, but sitting there and watching the movies and going through the exhibits really enlightened me, and it was so encouraging to see the school kids there, people who were obviously from all over the country and all over the world, and just the knowledge that's there at the National Park site. And I would have never thought that was a park site, but it was just wonderful to just get another historical perspective and some real information that is not necessarily, you know, commonly known. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, let's say, when Mrs. King passed away, they had to get a special dispensation, if you will, to have her buried side by side him, not under him, and the Congress had to approve that because it was making an alteration to a National Historical Site. And I was just so encouraged, and I would just like to say, if you're going to be in Atlanta, take a trip to the National King Memorial Site, because you will really be enlightened and encouraged.
Thanks, Rhonda.
Okay.
Yeah, Rhonda, you know, I had an opportunity a couple of months ago to go to the Central High School National Historic Site in Little Rock. And, you know, I'd heard the story of the Little Rock Nine, that Eisenhower federalized the National Guard and put there so that those nine young black children could go to that high school, and they forced the integration to occur there. And again, it's the power of the place. You know, as we walked through and we looked at those classrooms, and you look at that huge, massive school, and you walk through the gymnasium, and the interpretive ranger puts you back in that time, there's nothing like experiencing that history by being in that place. It really is powerful.
Now, Russ, 1964 was a big year for LBJ. Not only did he sign the Civil Rights Act in July of that year, which we have just marked the anniversary, but he also signed the Wilderness Act in September of 1964. Talk a little bit about how the Wilderness Act, you know, how important it's been to the park system and kind of what it does.
The Wilderness Act grew from about 8 million acres when he signed it in 1964 to currently almost 110 million acres. Much like the national parks, the wilderness areas are set aside as places that, as much as we can control, do not change. We don't allow any permanent structures or roads or anything like that into those places, and it provides an opportunity to go back into a completely natural setting. Of course, the nice benefit also to the ecology is that it provides corridors for wildlife. Mm-hmm. It protects habitat for birds and animals, and it allows Americans and people from around the world to get back in those places that aren't so familiar to them, that are really more the nature's backyard. But the wilderness areas are in the national forests, the national parks, the national wildlife refuges, and especially out in the west in the Bureau of Land Management areas. There's about 662 wilderness areas in our nation today in 44 of the states.
And the wilderness rules, from what I understand, they, as you just mentioned, all those different kinds of sites, they bridge all kinds of park designations, which seems like a pretty powerful tool for conservation.
Right. Guadalupe Mountains National Park is the only site in Texas that has designated wilderness area. But it does cross. It crosses from the Department of Agriculture and Department of Interior agencies such as the Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau of Land Management that manage those areas. But it's like there's Guadalupe National Park where you can do a lot of things, and then there's the wilderness area in there, which is much more limited on any kind of development or impact on that, because we really want to save it so people can really find their true natural outdoor experience.
And it's not just for us. It's for people hundreds of years from now. Hopefully we'll still have the opportunity to see some actual wilderness.
You know, that was one of the things that my boss told me after Mrs. Johnson died in 2007. We were walking through the Texas White House, and we were talking about, you know, the things we needed to do physically to the building and all. And he looked at me and he says, "Well, Russ, just remember, we're in this forever. Whatever we do here, we want to be part of protecting this place, or this landscape, or this battlefield, or this monument, or this historic home for all of those future generations that we can't even imagine. But what we do now is so important for what they will benefit from in the future."
Our phone number is 800-933-5372. You can also email us at think@kera.org, or send me a tweet. I'm at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. I'm in for Chris Boyd today, and we're talking about the national parks with specific focus on the Texas National Parks. And our guest is Russ Whitlock. He's the superintendent of the Lyndon Baines Johnson National Historical Park, and he also serves as the coordinator for Texas for the National Park System. Now, Russ, you mentioned Guadalupe Mountains National Park, which is in far west Texas, and of course we've got Big Bend National Park out there a little farther south. Talk a little bit about how those areas became parks and kind of, you know, what the thinking was there.
There's hardly a dot on the national park map. When you look at the national map and you see all the little dots with all the little different types of parks there, there's very few that did not begin with an idea of a citizen or a small group of folks sitting around a table somewhere that said, "We've got to set this aside." It's like the famous folklore story of Yellowstone, of the explorers in the 1850s that were exploring the great western areas, and were sitting around a campfire after they had seen geysers and huge waterfalls and the boiling mud pits of Yellowstone, and said, "Something's got to be done to protect this so that all people can enjoy it." You know, and Teddy Roosevelt, that we heard earlier, you know, one of his famous sayings we use a lot too is that they were the public pleasuring grounds. Hmm. So the idea of Big Bend and Guadalupe and Padre Island all started with individuals and citizens that said, "This is a very special place. It has some meaning, or it offers something that you can't find anywhere else, and it needs to be saved." And those people oftentimes work for years, sometimes even generations. The gentleman who I was reading this morning, getting ready for this, about the Wilderness Act, and the gentleman whose idea to actually have designated wilderness in our nation worked on that and pushed it and organized for 50 years, and then died 4 months before President Johnson signed the law. But it's that kind of commitment that that still supports and maintains the national parks today.
Now, we're going to have to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I want to take your pulse on what maybe one or two of your favorite hikes are in Texas. As we sort of look to the more natural park facilities, where do you love to go?
Well, you go to Guadalupe, and you see an actual exposed inland sea reef, and the fossils and the variety of the plant and animal life there is just incredible. You know, then you go to the other ecosystem of the Big Thicket, where east sort of meets west, mm-hmm. and you've got miles of hiking trails and canoe trails, where there are places in the springtime where you can round a bend on a trail and there will literally be hundreds of thousands of pitcher plants under those pine forests just spread there. So you take a hike on Padre Island, and if you're lucky enough early in the morning, you might see the Park Service releasing hundreds of the little Kemp's Ridley turtles, you know, that have been a tremendous success story about restoring that population of those endangered sea turtles. So it's, you know, Big Bend, maybe not so much this time, but
right, not this time of year for sure.
The spring and the fall. Oh, I mean, you feel like you're at the end of the world. I mean, the vistas and the views and the experiences that you get there are just something that you absolutely cannot experience on a computer screen or in a picture book. It's like the first time you walk out on the south rim of the Grand Canyon. And my experience was, I'm going out there and it's like, wow, this is going to be big. I've seen the pictures and all these kinds of things. And you walk out to the edge and you can't help but your lower jaw just drops. It's like, my God, there's no scale of measure on this thing. It's just tremendous. But you know, whether it's the Maggie Walker house in Virginia or the sequoia trees of Sequoia or Redwoods National Parks, they do oftentimes put us in a place where we feel somewhat insignificant, but at the same time very important in experiencing and sharing and being part of them.
Our guest is Russ Whitlock. He's the Texas National Parks Coordinator. We'll return to our conversation in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Already the national parks are beneficently affecting the national mind. Nowhere else do people from all the states mingle in quite the same spirit as they do in their national parks. One sits at dinner, say, between a Missouri farmer and an Idaho miner, and at supper between a New York artist and an Oregon shopkeeper. One climbs mountains with a chance crowd from Vermont, Louisiana, and Texas, and sits around the evening campfire with a California grape grower, a locomotive engineer from Massachusetts, and a banker from Michigan. Here, the social differences so insisted on at home just don't exist. Perhaps for the first time, one realizes the common America and loves it. In the national parks, all are just Americans.
Those are the words of Robert Sterling Yard, a writer and wilderness activist, as portrayed in Ken Burns' excellent miniseries, The National Parks. Our guest this hour is Russ Whitlock. He's the Texas National Parks Coordinator. He's superintendent of the LBJ National Historical Park. I'm Jeff Whittington, in for Chris Boyd today. And Russ, those words about the parks being for everybody, the parks are designed for people to come. I mean, there's got to be a challenge there when you have to, you know, preserve, maintain, and then also open them up to people and then, you know, protect the people and protect the place. Can you talk a little bit about those special challenges?
Yeah, 282 million visitors in 2012. That was the most recent information I could get. The end of the Organic Act said that we save them unimpaired for future generations. It is a constant evaluation and recheck that park managers and rangers and maintenance people do on a regular basis of sharing as much as we can while at the same time keeping that resource or that place unimpaired for future generations. It's not an easy task oftentimes, especially with modern technologies and new ways of doing things. You know, can mountain bikers and hikers and horse riders all coexist in the same areas, or do you have to set those different, or where do you let people experience and execute their First Amendment rights to free speech and to pass out literature? Those are just the tip of the iceberg. But it's been working for the most part for almost 100 years. And that was a great quote there. As I sat and looked at on my computer right now, I've got the whole National Park Service system map pulled up. You know, and as I heard the narrator speaking, my eyes were just bouncing from one place to another. When we think of national parks, we often think of Yellowstone and Grand Tetons and the Great Smokies and the Everglades and the vast areas of Alaska. But there's also the Pearl Harbor and the Japanese American internment camps and the Brown versus Board of Education site that tell such important stories about that, and I think it's just thrilling, that our citizens are still inquisitive and they still want to know and they still want to experience those places. And it is I've always felt like it was a great honor and responsibility that the American public have entrusted in me and about 20,000 others to be good stewards of these places.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number, and that's where we find Jen in Dallas. Hello, Jen.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to ask a question, but also you mentioned, or I'm sorry, the guest mentioned Brown v. Board of Education site, and I have to say I love going to the national parks throughout the country, and that was the most moving national park that I've ever been to, or national site, I mean. But my question was, you were talking earlier about replacing some of the wood, either old decomposing wood and with the same wood, or with wood that's of the same type. And I was wondering if you've ever come across the problem of threatened or endangered species that have ever needed to replace the wood or anything that was used.
It's a good question. Russ?
Jen, certainly, we definitely would make considerations for something like that. Something that a material that may have been very prevalent and easily available in the 18th or 19th century may now not be something that we can, in good conscience or in our preservation ethic, use today. So we will make modifications when we need to. Sometimes there are things that we just cannot in any way figure out how to replace it in kind. And when those occasions happen, we well document, we photograph, we say this is why and how, so that 50 and 100 years from now, somebody that's opening up an adobe or a historic home or something and finds something in there and goes, what is this? They can look back and go, oh, that's what they did and why they did. So when we can't use the original material or a replacement of the original, we well document it.
We got an email to think@kera.org from Kelly in Dallas. who writes, I adore the Guadalupe Mountains and Carlsbad Caverns National Parks and have done some wonderful backpacking between them via the Lincoln National Forest. Does your guest know of any plans for future connections or collaborations between those parks?
Right offhand, I don't know about one in the Lincoln National Forest, but I would say that there's it's a high probability and a possibility. The National Park Service has an organization called the Rivers and Trails Conservation Assistance Program, and we work with other local, state, federal agencies, non-governmental agencies to address access issues. Down in Houston, there was just one of the bayou riverways that was opened up for canoeing, and there's lots of natural habitat. I went canoeing down there last spring, and you know, you're right there in right outside of downtown Houston, and yet here's eagle's nest and all up here like this. So it, through the RTCA cooperative assistance program, I would say that if it's a popular area and it's getting a lot of use and there are people like yourself that are asking for more, they're probably got something on the planning board.
So Gene and Grapevine also emailed us at think@kera.org. And Gene writes, I know this is mostly about Texas, but has your guest been to all the national parks, including the sand dunes in the middle of the tundra in Alaska?
June, I sure wish I had done it. You know, that's on my bucket list, is to get as many as I can, you know, after I'm retired.
You spend a lot of time at one, right?
You know, what's your favorite national park? And, oh, gosh, you know, every person you ask that's traveled the country is gonna have this list that's going to start off automatically with them, because you never know what that individual's going to connect with, you know. And we run into American tourists frequently that it is their goal to get to every single national park, which I oftentimes say, so you're going to American Samoa and Guam also?
Right.
Because those are national park sites too. And sometimes they'll look at me a little troubled and go, I'm going to have trouble getting the motor home there, but we'll work out something to go.
800-933-5372. Let's get another phone call from Jeannie in McKinney. Hello, Jeannie.
Hi there. How are you?
Hey, doing well.
Great show. So fascinating. I just had a comment or question about the LBJ Ranch.
Okay.
We visited it years ago, and we're expecting a wonderful place with lots of history. But what struck me the most was the serenity of the place. I mean, it was like you were transported to just a calm environment, and I never could figure out why, but I wondered if other people had had the same reaction.
Lucy Baines Johnson, the younger daughter of the president, Mrs. Johnson, will often say that Mama and Daddy liked to come here so much because at the end of the day, when the meetings were over, there was such a calm and serene nature to the place that they could get out on a drive and drive around the hill country roads and recharge their batteries. Mrs. Johnson, in some film footage that I've seen, says, I can only imagine what the leaders of the world, you know, who came from palaces and castles and all of different countries, you know, came to this humble little home of the 36th president. But she also added, of all the places they had been and all the people they have known, no matter where they traveled, they always wanted to come home to what they call their heart's home. And Mrs. Johnson said, you know, never let this place become a sterile relic of the past. And that's one challenge we have at this particular park of keeping it alive and vibrant and an operating cattle ranch, so that when you drive in your modern car, you can almost feel like, you know, you're riding through in a 60s convertible Lincoln.
Hmm. Let's get one more call here from Mark in Fort Worth. Hello, Mark.
Hey there. Excellent show, just like the other callers have said. And I was just curious. I have two daughters who are in high school, and both my daughters are very interested in the national parks and those kind of careers. What kind of educational path would you suggest that we kind of steer them toward?
You know, Mark, a four-year degree is the key to the front door. I would greatly encourage them during their college time to volunteer or get involved in the Student Conservation Association or get one of the summer seasonal jobs. They're as wide and varied as the parks are. I've got young folks here that are working at this park that have biology and botany degrees, and they're working on history projects and giving programs. That good 4-year science or liberal arts degree, once we get you in the front door, we can provide you firefighting training, law enforcement training, educational training, things like that to give you the tools to be able to do the job.
So, Russ, we just have a couple of minutes left. I'm curious if you know of any potential new national parks on the horizon, or can talk a little bit about, you know, what it might take for another national park to be established in the states.
Certainly, the growth of national parks of the large areas has slowed tremendously mm-hmm. in the last 50 years. You just don't see the big, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres coming in. Although there has been for over 25 years now an ongoing movement in Maine for a national park there in the Maine woods, or the Great Maine Woods. Good friend of ours at the Sun to Moon Gallery in Dallas, he's been been shooting a lot of photographs up there for years to try to help share those. That's what the people, the artists did in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. They went west, and it was a lot of their landscape paintings that convinced the population of the East that, wow, that we really do need to preserve those places. But there's, you know, the history of the United States is being made every day, and discoveries are still being made. Right up the road from me in Waco, there's the Waco Mammoth site, and you know what started as a bone sticking out of the side of the Bosque River has become an incredible park there that the Park Service has been a little affiliated with and learning along with others on that one too, because it holds right there in Waco the largest collection of Colombian mammoth remains known anywhere in the world. So places like that are still being found and discovered, historical events and figures that are may now just be being realized for and recognized for the impact of that place or that time are going to be additions to the system.
Russ Whitlock is the Texas coordinator for the National Park Service and superintendent of the Lyndon Baines Johnson National Historical Park. Russ, thank you again so much for being with us today.
I've really enjoyed it, Jeff. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Chris Boyd will be back in this chair on Monday. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Whittington, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Stay with us. In the next hour, we're going to talk about the history of the Dallas music scene with Alan Governor. But for right now, I'm Jeff Whittington. Thank you so much for tuning in, and have a great afternoon.